Hi, I'm Brian.
And I'm Sharon.
I had a 40-year porn addiction.
Porn was an unwelcome guest for 32 years of our marriage.
I found hope and freedom when I attended a Gateway to Freedom weekend.
And I found hope and the courage to begin my healing journey while attending Wives Care.
Don't be like us and allow porn to wreak havoc in your lives.
Reach out to Be Broken today.
To learn more about Gateway to Freedom, 3-day intensive for men, and Wives Care online groups, visit BeBroken.org or call 210-822-8201. That's BeBroken.org or 210-822-8201.
There are two things that really matter. The first is that secure attachment is actually built through the process of rupture and repair. So it's okay to have the rupture. It's okay to not be perfect as long as we learn how to repair, which looks like going back and saying, hey, I didn't feel good about how that went down between us. Can we talk about what that was like for you? And can I make amends for that? And can we try again? And the second thing I've held on to so tightly is like just good enough. Good enough. I'm just shooting for like 60% secure attachment or 70% functional adult or whatever the different theories say. There's always a good enough point.
Good day, friends. Jonathan Darty here with another episode of the PSR podcast, which is a listener-supported outreach of Be Broken Ministries. In today's episode, I sit down with Kat Etherington, who's the director of recovery at the Naked Truth Project. And we're going to explore how addiction impacts parenting and family dynamics. Kat openly shares her personal journey through addiction and recovery, offering some powerful insights into how addiction disrupts the parent-child attachment and can create generational cycles of shame. Together, we discuss practical ways that parents in recovery can stabilize their family environment, communicate honestly with their children, and navigate the process of rupture and repair. Kat also offers encouraging words about making amends without shame and reminds us that healing is always possible no matter where you are in your journey. For more info about Kat and the resources at Naked Truth Project, visit nakedtruthproject.com. For additional resources, you can visit our website at bebroken.org or check out the links that we're going to put in today's show notes. And of course, friends, I want to encourage you to rate and review the podcast after listening on whatever platform you get PSR Podcast. Now let's go ahead and dive into today's hope-filled conversation with Kat. Well, all right, we have back on the program with us Kat Etherington. So Kat, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Jonathan. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to hear your voice. And, you know, since about a month ago or several weeks ago when we were originally planning to do this, you were not feeling up to it. And so it's good to see that you're feeling much better and that you've got your voice back. So we're glad to have you on.
Yeah, thank you. For someone who likes to talk as much as I do, having no voice is particularly painful. So yeah, I'm glad to be back on all cylinders.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and I'm excited about this conversation because I think it's going to be extremely relevant to a lot of parents that are navigating what does it look like when a parent has experienced addiction, maybe even the trauma of addiction, and what does that do? How do you then navigate the responsibilities of parenting in the middle of all of that? So before we get into the details of that conversation, can you share with our audience, especially maybe our newer listeners who are unfamiliar with you and the work you do, a little bit about what you do with Naked Truth?
Yeah, thank you. So yeah, my name's Kat Etherington. My job at Naked Truth is that I am the director of recovery. And for those of you who haven't heard about Naked Truth, we are a UK-based international charity working in the area of pornography. And our mission is to open eyes and free lives from the damaging impacts of pornography. And so we do that work in those two kind of sections, if you like. Our open eyes work is primarily around education and awareness. And we do a lot of work with parents and families and schools and churches around the issue of pornography, particularly. And then in our free lives work, which is really the work that I'm most involved with, that's around recovery and healing and freedom. And so in that area, we aim to free lives from the damaging impacts of pornography and other problematic sexual behaviors. And that looks like working with men, women, couples, and families to help heal some of the woundedness that comes from those kind of sexual issues.
Yeah, yeah. And our conversation today, I think, is going to be extremely relevant because I don't know about you guys, but in our ministry, I'd say at least, 75 to 80% of all of the couples that we seek to help are parents as well. And so there's an impact that goes beyond the individual, certainly when you're talking about maybe a couple, but then there's the impact of what happens in the family and even how that impacts generations and parenting. So let's dive in there and just, can you kind of set the scenario for us of what is the, just kind of from the 30,000 foot view, what are we looking at when we're talking about a parent who has experienced addiction and maybe now they're ready to acknowledge and start to deal with that? What kind of impact does addiction have on the family unit?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting place to start because immediately that makes me want to acknowledge that addiction, when it is present in the family system, whether it is known or not known, is having an impact on every member of that system. For those of your listeners who are not familiar with my own personal story, I have been a person with an addiction and I have been a person impacted in a traumatic way by someone else's addiction. And I have raised my children in the context of recovery from those addictions, whether that's my own recovery or my husband's. And so I have a real interest in how we help the next generation with the impact that addiction and recovery have had on them. And so I think my starting place would be to say, even before the addiction is known within the family system, it is clear to me that there is an impact already happening for the children and young people living within that family system. Because inevitably, if there is a secret within a family, then there are mechanisms in place to protect that secret, and the children are exposed to whatever those relational mechanisms are, and are growing up within a family where there is some kind of unhealth playing out within the dynamics. And so we tend to think more about the family dynamics when, the discovery has just happened and everyone's in crisis. And of course, there are impacts happening there. But I think I'm just highlighting the fact that even before that discovery happens, there will be stuff happening in the family system that is rubbing off on the kids. And when I think about that in my own context, I think one of the most important things I've learned as a parent in recovery from addiction and a parent parenting kids through a crisis of betrayal in my relationship is that my emotional immaturity, my lack of emotional capacity has for sure had an impact on my children who are now becoming adults and going into life as kind of grown-ups and still navigating some of the impacts of that.
Yeah, as we're doing this recording, just this week, we released a podcast that I had done with Dr. Eddie Caparucci.
Okay.
And the whole idea of that podcast was reframing recovery as emotional regulation. And so what you're talking about there is, and sometimes there's just that deception that happens in addiction, right? Of like, hey, I can handle this and I can compartmentalize this. And as long as it's not like known, as long as these behaviors remain private and hidden, it's not having any kind of real impact on others. And we don't realize what even just that self-deception is right. doing to shutting us down, keeping us separate. Talk a little bit about, because one of the major issues of family dynamics is attachment theory, right?
Yeah.
What impact does addiction have on attachment between parent and child?
Yeah, that's got to be significant. I think, you know, even as you were talking and, you know, mentioning Eddie Capirucci, and I know his material is largely around this kind of inner child stuff. And I was thinking about how we can really only parent our children to the capacity that we can parent ourselves, right? And so many of us have issues in attachment and that were formed within our relationships with our parents and caregivers that we often are very unaware of until something happens that brings our attention to them. And I would say my own personal experience is definitely that. You know, I wouldn't have known some of the stuff that was going on for me until I eventually had to go figure it out because it was causing consequences in my life. What I know that a lot of people experience is that we parent the way that we were parented because that's the role modeling that we've had. And or we like completely swing the other way and we go, I don't want to be anything like my parents. And so we do it very differently. And often both of those are not optimal parenting because it will have caused some of the attachment injuries that we have experienced that we are now kind of passing on with our children. So I know that one of the things that I had a tendency to do with my kids was to shame them as a way to get them in line. I didn't know that's what I was doing, but now that I know better, I can see that that was kind of a tool that I learned from my parents, that fear and shame were the mechanisms by which they got me in line. And that's how I learned to parent my kids. And it's only when I begin to understand the impact that parenting had on me that I was able to make those changes. And I think it all really comes down to how we understand and learn what it means to be safe in relationship, which is really what attachment theory is all about, right? Like how do we keep ourselves safe and connected in relationships? And for me, that was compliance. I learned to be very compliant, that when I was doing what I was supposed to be doing, I was loved. And when I stepped outside of that, there was a rupture in attachment. And that's what that kind of fear and shame did for me. What's interesting for me, though, is that I have two daughters who are older, they're young adults now, and I probably would have told you that one of them particularly wasn't really affected by my addiction. And I know now that's because she is on the more avoidant attachment end of things. And so she has learned that in order to stay connected with me, she doesn't need to be a bother. You know, she needs to be quiet and not make a fuss. And so what looked like she's okay was actually she's holding back. She's not being honest, because what she had learned through the attachment parenting that I had offered her was that the way to get love and kind of approval was to be quiet. So I do think it's fascinating to watch young people grow up and think about the assumptions that we make about how they're doing based on behaviors that actually could be actually expressing some of that attachment stuff in themselves.
Yeah. Now, before we get to some of like, okay, what do you do? How do you actually navigate this well? How can there be repair and all of that? I want to highlight a couple of things you've said. You've brought it up a couple of times about how even addiction sort of stunts us. There's an immaturity that comes, and we don't mean that in a shameful way, but just the idea of like you don't know what you don't know, and it yeah. kind of it locks us into a self focus and maybe an immature understanding of relationships. The other thing you said is that, you know, you used kind of shaming as a parenting tactic, which there's a little bit of an irony there, because how much shame is associated with addiction?
Yeah.
So it's almost like the further you go into addiction, you're like, I have to hide more and more and more because it's so shameful. I can't imagine if my kids knew, if people knew, if, and so can you talk a little bit about just what the prison of addiction does in sort of perpetuating that idea of compartmentalization, which brings about immaturity and shame? How it's almost as if the effects of addiction then become generational. Can you talk yeah. about the impact of what that is? And then we'll talk about how you break that, because it can be broken. You can break
Absolutely.
That generational.
Yeah. And I mean, that's why I feel equipped to talk about this, because I feel like the work that I've been doing on myself has equally positively impacted my family as the lack of work I was doing on myself that was negatively impacting my family. And so, you know, it's what's been interesting to me as a practitioner in this space is to do that kind of attachment work with my clients and do that family of origin work with my clients and really start to see the patterns that show up in this area. And I am fairly convinced that what I would call developmental trauma, and you and I talked about that on a previous podcast, and the shame associated with learning to shape myself in a way that is acceptable to others, is at the root of a lot of addictive behavior. And so there's shame on like the what maybe on the front end, like I feel bad about the things that I've done. But really, I'm talking about the shame that is like that is woven into our sense of identity that says it's not okay to be myself, fully myself. And so I can't be myself and be loved. And I guess I learned a lot of that in my childhood and how I was parented. So when I was being good, and then I was accepted and loved and rewarded. When I was acting out, I was met with what my parents would have called discipline, but what I experienced as an unacceptability and a disapproval that meant that there was rupture without repair. You know, discipline is not in and of itself bad, but discipline that comes with enough love, care, and communication that helps you to know that you can be making bad choices and still be loved and still be a good person. I didn't get enough of that. And I learned to do that to my kids. And so, you know, I could name 3 or 4 specific examples with my kids where eventually it caused me to take a step back and say, oh, okay, if they had like a voice of shame in their head, it would come with my voice. And I didn't feel good about that once I'd learned enough that was kind of getting my attention. So I think addiction becomes a coping mechanism. For some people, it becomes a coping mechanism for shame. But of course, it is also in and of itself often a shameful behavior. And so then the shame gets perpetuated in the addiction cycle, and you get locked in this prison where the way I relieve my shame is also shame inducing. And so we go around and around this cycle. And I think what I've learned about shame and parenting is that when I would shame my children, it was often to do with managing my own shame. Like somehow their behavior reflected badly on me, and I couldn't tolerate the shame that I felt around my kids acting out. And so instead I would push that shame onto them to try to get them to behave so that I could manage that shameful feeling in myself. So I think it's a prison, and it's a prison we often push onto other people to try to manage ourselves.
Yeah, and that prison, like you're saying there, it really, we don't even recognize it in the moment, but we're really saying it's really all about me. It's still all about me. That's what addiction does. It makes this incredibly self-absorbed over focus on self. So then when your kids are just doing what 4-year-olds do or 7-year-olds do in terms of just, I mean, they're ignorant. They're going to do stupid things. They're going to, you know, have outbursts or whatever. Right. And then it's like, oh, but that's all about me. It's all about me. Yes. And so then you're trying to just kind of tamp them down. Can we talk now? So let's start to shift into, all right, let's bring some hope into this. So for parents who, and usually by the time parents engage with our ministries, they have come to a place of saying, I'm acknowledging there's awareness. I have an addiction. I have something that's out of control. I have a behavior that I want to address. And so they're getting into their personal recoveries. They're starting to understand what it's going to take for them to be free from these things that they've done and start to live in a new way. But let's talk about how that intersects then with the parenting. And what does it look like when somebody who's been experiencing addiction starts to get into recovery? How important, let's start here. How important is just stabilizing the environment to kind of navigate? Like, what's the foundational aspects of starting to stabilize the environment before you can get to some of the deeper work of maybe the parent-child relationship repair?
Yeah. I'm glad that you said that, because stabilizing the environment is everything that you could be wanting to try to do in the very beginning, because usually, you know, when there's a discovery of, you know, in our particular context, we're talking about sex addiction, you know, that is a different beast than an alcohol addiction or a drug addiction. So for me, it was drugs. And so it wasn't a massive shock discovery, because when it's very hard to hide a substance abuse issue or an alcohol issue. But of course, you and I both know that when we're talking about a secret sexual behavior, that can be hidden for a very long time. And so the discovery of that is usually different, more chaotic and more kind of crisis than it is in other types of addiction, because it will often have been discovered when there has been no prior warning or knowledge. And so just the dynamics of how that happens are often very traumatic, as we know, for a family system. And so you're not even really going to be thinking about, you know, repairing attachment wounds with your children whilst you're in the middle of the crisis that's playing out in the context of your family, right? Like, and so I don't want people who are navigating betrayal trauma and the crisis of kind of finding that stuff out to be worrying about how much they might be damaging their children or the damage that might have already been caused. Actually, the only job that matters in the middle of that crisis is to try to bring as much safety and stability into that situation as you can. And then, as you rightly say, sometime down the line, we're going to get to understanding the attachment issues within our family system. But that's not immediate work. I think with kids in the immediate aftermath of discovery around sexual betrayal and addiction issues, the most important thing that we can do is provide them with a narrative, enough of a story that they're not left to make sense of what's happening around them without help from you as their parent. And that doesn't mean we have to make big disclosures. It doesn't mean we have to say dad's a sex addict. It doesn't mean we need to say dad hurt mum even, but it might be that we need to say enough that we can say that thing that you're experiencing, that energy that you're picking up, the tension in the home, the secret conversation and the raised voices, that's really happening. That's an important message for kids so that they learn that they can trust their own instincts and that they read reality properly. And then we need to say enough that they know it's not about you. You're not doing something wrong. This is a grown-up issue and we still love you and we care about you and we're going to make sure that you're safe and okay. And the other thing that I wish I had known when I was in early recovery myself is that we have a responsibility as parents to make sure that we own our emotions and to make sure that our kids know that they're not responsible for looking after us. Because that's, I think, one of the mistakes that sometimes we make as parents is we're so hurting in our own stuff that we might lean on our kids in a way that isn't always appropriate. And so I think if we could get people just doing that, just acknowledging the chaos, being honest about the fact that there is something happening, helping kids have enough story that they know I didn't do something wrong, because kids will, in a similar way, you know, we talked about addicts are selfish. Kids can be selfish too, in a self-centered kind of I make sense of the world based on me in the center of it kind of a way. And if we don't give them enough story, they'll try to figure out what they're doing that's causing the chaos, right? So if we could just do those basic things and let our kids know you didn't do this and I'm going to take care of me and I'm going to take care of you too, that would be a really great start.
That's so good. And it, you know, makes me think of the, I don't remember who originally said this, but the idea that kids are great observers, but terrible interpreters.
Right.
And so they're observing everything that's going on. They're very good at just kind of getting a vibe, but that doesn't mean an 8-year-old knows how to interpret what that means. And so I love that you're saying you're giving enough context for a child to be able to understand where some of those lines are drawn, where they don't have to carry certain things that are not their burden to carry. How important also is it for allowing and maybe even verbalizing this of if you're feeling something, if you have a question for mommy or daddy or whatever, please ask it. Like, how important is it to build that bridge so they don't feel like you've told them what they need to know and there's nothing else that they could ever be inquisitive about?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that you brought that up too, because that is really important that we do enough to leave the door open. Because, you know, depending on how much our kids know, sometimes they don't want more information. They don't, especially if they have a sense that it has anything to do with sex or sexual behavior. Depending on the age of your kids, they don't want to know about mum and dad and sex, right? Some of them. And so we want to always kind of land just below the bar, in the sense that we leave space for them to ask more, but we also let them be in the space where maybe they don't want more. Maybe what they need is just enough reassurance, but not the whole story. And so I do think it's important that we leave space for them to grow into, to come and ask more. And we always make sure that they know that the door is open for that. Now, that might feel really difficult if we're very emotionally dysregulated ourselves. And so again, I think there are ways that we can model to our children how to experience our emotions in a truthful, authentic, and hopefully somewhat healthy and contained way. And so, you know, if you're crying in the shower, it's okay to tell your kids, you know, I'm just having a really hard day. I'm feeling some sad feelings. But I'm okay, and we're okay, and you're okay. And sometimes people get sad. And so if you get sad and you want to come talk to me about that, let's make sure that we do that. And sometimes we're not going to have the emotional capacity for that either. And I also think that's okay. In the middle of our own crises, sometimes our kids are going to need something from us that we can't provide. And I think it's okay for us to try and pull in some support, some community. You know, hopefully we've got a little village at least that we can say, hey, actually, mum's having a tough day, but grandma's here for you today. And then when I'm feeling a little bit better, I can go back and pick that up with my kids. I think what's been really reassuring to me as a parent, and I often, when I talk about this, have said, you know, I've done a lot of training on attachment theory and, you know, these kind of ideas. And every time I sit in a training on attachment theory, I get the same feeling of, oh, I've screwed up my kids. And every time I come back to this, like, okay, there is a line that is good enough parenting, you know? And so I've heard, you know, 60% secure attachment is enough to be good enough. And so I'm like, okay, I always come back to this place of like, okay, there are two things that really matter. The first is that secure attachment is actually built through the process of rupture and repair. So it's okay to have the rupture. It's okay to not be perfect, as long as we learn how to repair, which looks like going back and saying, hey, I didn't feel good about how that went down between us. Can we talk about what that was like for you? And can I make amends for that? And can we try again? And so I got real good at humbling myself and apologizing and kind of going back for a do-over with my kids. And the second thing I've held on to so tightly is like, just good enough, good enough. I'm just shooting for like 60%. A secure attachment, or 70% functional adult, or whatever the different theories say. There's always a good enough point.
Well, and one little thing that I would add to that too, because I can empathize with some of that, those shame feelings and everything, is the idea that God loves my kids more and better than I ever could. Mm. So there is a sense in which it's like, okay, I can kind of rest in the fact that he's the one that ultimately, they were in his mind before they were ever in mine. And so it's like, he loves them. He can, there's a resiliency, there's a repair that he can do that even we can't do. But I want to talk a little bit about where you landed there for a second, because, you know, one of the things we realize when we get into recovery is there's all kinds of new insights that we gain, especially around this issue of emotional regulation and learning how to, I never even knew about attunement. I never knew about some of these. I don't know about window of tolerance. I didn't know. There's so many things that you start to learn and grow in. How does a parent take that growth that they've been doing in the recovery and translate it into their relationship with their kids, while still maintaining that boundary between, I have environments and engagements that I have at an adult level with peers and counselors that are helping me personally, but I still also have this responsibility to my children, and I want to humble myself and teach them and show them where I'm growing in some of these areas. Does that make sense? How do you keep that boundary there? Because sometimes, you know, parents, because they've been addicted, there's still that immaturity. And so they just, they just start almost like having a counseling session with their kids. And let me tell you all this stuff that I'm going.
Right.
So help us navigate that.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. And I think the honest answer to that is imperfectly and as a work in progress. We're not going to get that right straight away because we're in our own process of maturing, right? And so we will, there's no question for me that we will do that immaturely. And, I guess I would have a lot of grace for trying to do something is usually better than doing nothing and continuing to do whatever it is that we've been doing if what we've been doing is harmful and hurtful. And I think you're really onto something that sometimes we want to, I guess it comes from fear. I remember having a lot of fear around my kids are going to grow up to be addicts like I was, and desperately wanting to stop that from happening. And so, you try to therapize them in the way that you're being, you're learning all of that stuff. I think over time, what I have come to understand is that my kids are not a project to be performed. They are people to be known. And, I think I really actually probably learned this most through the family of origin work I've done with clients over the years. And it's become very, very clear to me that what children need is a parent who is willing to take the time to know them as individual people and to parent the child that they have. By which I mean, truly, I have two children who in some ways almost have a different parent, but in a good way, because what I'm trying to do is meet the person in front of me. And my two daughters are very different people. One is more on the anxious end of the attachment spectrum and one is more on the avoidant end. And so they need different things from me. My youngest needs a lot of handholding and support and encouragement. My oldest is more likely to run off and be independent because she doesn't need that same stuff. So I think, a lot of healthy parenting is less about trying to teach them all these skills and more about trying to listen to who they are and respond to the individual needs that they have. And that's really hard to do if you have been prone to compartmentalization and lack of empathy. I think in order to maintain an addiction, you have to separate yourself from the people around you that might be harmed. And so, I think having kids is like a masterclass in empathetic attunement, if you let it be. And I think that's going to take time. I would say I've been in recovery for 18 years. And I only just the last few years feel like I'm getting a grip on what it is to be a healthy, attached parent.
Yeah. Well, I've got one, maybe two more questions before we wrap up. One is, we've touched on it a little bit, and the need for apologizing. How can a parent do that well without being drowning in shame? Because, I think when you start to realize, you've even kind of shared a little bit as you've shared your own story here of just the idea of, oh my goodness, did I ruin my kids? Are they going to be addicts? Are they, there's so much regret. And yeah. I think there's a healthy regret. I was in my own world. I was detached. I was not actually being the fully present parent that I was meant to be. So there is a need for apologizing. And obviously there's age ranges here and age specific, all that kind of stuff. But can you walk us through what's a good way to apologize, realizing that it's not going to be a one and done kind of thing, but what's a good way to become a person who's humble and apologetic without it being overwhelmed by shame?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not easy to do. And I think, if you were to ask me what's the most important thing that somebody can do to become a better parent, I would say do your own work. That's the most important thing that any of us can do, because we cannot push out into the world what we have not got. inside of us, right? And so, you know, becoming a mature person is the only way to become a mature parent. And as you're talking about apology, I want to share with you something that I learned in my early recovery, which was so helpful for me, which actually has less to do with apology and more to do with amends, which for me are slightly different propositions. So for sure, an apology can be part of what it means to make amends. But one of my mentors early on said, you know, if you have a hole in your sock, the way that you mend that is to make it so that it's not got a hole in it anymore. And so amends is not about saying, I'm sorry, there's a hole. It's about getting out a needle and thread and closing up the hole so that it's mended. There's a sort of an action orientation in that. And that was super helpful to me to know, okay, I'm not apologizing, I'm mending, I'm restoring something to, which feels very biblical to me too, right? Like there's a restoration process here. And so they said to me, work out what's broken. That's your first job. Work out what's broken. What did you take? What did you steal? What did you neglect? What did you kind of break? And then you go about the process of mending that and restoring it to what it should have been. And so with my kids, I honestly sat down with a piece of paper and I thought, okay, what did I do that shouldn't have been done? What did I break? What's broken? What did I neglect? And so for us, it was really practical stuff like time. I didn't spend time with my children. I robbed them of time. And so my amends was less about, I'm sorry for that, and more about making time. I broke their trust. And so my amends was more about living trustworthy than it was about saying sorry. And I guess for us, the apologies came much later as they started to verbalize their questions and hit some of their struggles. And actually, it's been as they've kind of navigated those teenage years that stuff's come up that I've had to say, you know, I think that might be down to these experiences that we had. And that's probably been more the place where I've been able to say, you know, I think I did that. I think I did that. And I probably have gotten better at that as I've done more of my own shame work. So, you know, as to how do you not drown in shame, you have to do your own shame work around that. And the process of looking someone in the eye, I tell you what, kids are incredibly forgiving of their parents. You know, what I've found is that my kids have a capacity for grace that I have never really experienced anywhere else but Jesus. And when I've been able to look them in the eye and say, I think I did that. And sometimes that's come with tears and they've cried and they've been really beautiful healing moments, actually in many ways as much for me as for them. And so I think a lot of that shame reduction actually happens in the process of living that out. I hope that's helpful. I'm not sure whether that translates well for people, but that's been my experience.
No, that's excellent. I love that idea of mending and seeking to actually make things right. So before we wrap up, I can imagine we have parents that are in this situation. They're, whether they are they're the ones that have an addiction, or maybe they're in relationship with the one who has an addiction, and just all the chaos and everything that's blown up there. And they're hearing what we're talking about here. Maybe there's a sense of like, okay, I'm starting to get a framework, but they can just, maybe they're feeling overwhelmed. They're feeling exhausted. Maybe they're feeling like, I don't know if I can do this. Can you just give a word of hope to those who are out there who are just wherever they may be in the journey? Maybe it's step one that they're having to take and they're like, I don't know if I can do this. Or maybe they're a little ways down the road and they're starting to realize, wow, there's more repair here than I thought that needed to be done. Can you just give hope for the journey for those who are in this situation?
Yeah, I love that you want to finish there. I think I would say there is more repair work than you think there is. And there is more time than you think there is. This doesn't have to be repaired today. It doesn't have to be repaired tomorrow. You know, kids, their brains are still forming well into early adulthood. And so, you know, there truly is written into our design the opportunity for healing. The brain is plastic and elastic. And so we can keep doing that work for as long as it takes for those relationships to be repaired. And so I would say, don't give up. Don't believe the lie that because it's not fixed today, it can never be fixed. My experience is, and you know, we're still working on it for sure, but my experience is that lots and lots of repair can happen, but it's going to happen in the small actions on a day-to-day basis. So don't give up.
That's so good. Well, Kat, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. And so thank you for sharing your life and your wisdom with us. Where can our listeners and viewers go to learn about the work you're doing and the resources that you all provide?
Yeah, so you can find us at nakedtruthproject.com. You can learn all about our Open Eyes work as well as our Free Lives work through the website.
That's awesome. Well, thanks again, Kat, for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, friends, we are going to put those resources into the show notes. And so please check out Naked Truth Project. And we want to help you take your next best step to wholeness in Christ. So please reach out to us. And we look forward to seeing you back here again next time on the Pure Sex Radio program. Take care.